You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, continuing now with the story of Richard Phillips, newly exonerated, thanks to the efforts of the Michigan Innocence Clinic. Its founder, David Moran, says this case should teach police, prosecutors, and attorneys to leave no stone unturned.
Richard's case, he did more than 45 years in prison, which is the longest that anyone has served and been exonerated, according to the National Registry of Exonerations. But his case is special because it shows that there's really no point back in time beyond which we can say, well, we don't need to go there, no matter how far they are.
So we turn now to Richard Phillips. Richard, after 47 years in prison, you've been out on bond since December, and at the end of March, you were officially exonerated and became a free man. How have you been getting along since getting out of prison?
Well, I've been trying to get my financial situation squared away because as you get out of prison, usually if you've done a crime, what will happen is that they have these reentry programs set up for guys to come out that don't have anything like money and family and so forth. And so these reentry programs kind of halfway give them a chance to get started in life and get your life back in order and have you be in a position to where as though you can kind of halfway live normal without any kind of scuffling and struggling and so forth. But with exonerees, they don't really have programs set up for exonerees yet. Probably in the future, maybe they will have some people set up to help exonerees because exonerees' situations is somewhat different. You get to the point where they say, well, okay, you're not guilty. Now we're going to let you go, okay? But you're on your own. So how do you make it on no assistance from the state, no health insurance, no food stamps, nothing? So I had to go through the process of not only getting some financial help, but I also had to get my Social Security card, identification, ID card. I didn't have any of that stuff. All that stuff was lost. Driver's license, everything was lost while I was gone for 47 years of my life. So I had to redo everything. Sometimes I had to go back and forth, back and forth. If you don't have this, you can't get this. If you don't have that, you can't get that. So it was a process, but now I've gotten to the point now where I'm kind of getting indoctrinated to everything that's going on. So I'm doing pretty good now. I'm staying with a friend. And so once the little money that I've actually applied for it starts to come in, they've increased my food stamps somewhat. So I'm doing a lot better than I was when I first got out.
So thinking about when you got out, Michigan Department of Corrections did what for you when you were released?
Not a whole lot.
How about the state or any Wayne County agency?
Not a whole lot.
You were flying on your own.
That's right. I was just glad to be free.
I'm sure.
So when I got out, people were talking about compensation and what you got coming and all of this, but that was never entered into my thoughts. My thought was just to be free. After 47 years of incarceration, staying in cold, dark cells, locked up, lonely, lost my family, lost everything. My kids lost everything. So now, after they released me, the process, I had to start like from scratch. It was almost like being born again. I had to learn how to use phones. I had to learn how to shop. I still don't know how to pump gas yet. There's a lot of things that have changed. So I have to I'm still learning.
And I'm in that day-to-day, just looking around and realizing how much things have changed in nearly five decades. What have been some of the most challenging adjustments for you? You were saying even cell phone.
Well, let's see. I had to get used to buckling up the seatbelt.
Because that wasn't the law then.
Yeah. I could just get in the car and take off. Nowadays, if you get in the car, you better buckle your seatbelt up. If you don't want to get a ticket, buckle your seatbelt up. Not only for that, but for your health and for the safety of other people as well. So that was an adjustment. Shopping was an adjustment. I had to get used to the crowds. You know, being in prison, you're surrounded by untrustworthy people all the time. There's a lot of people in there that are halfway coherent, but there's a lot of people also in there that's not coherent.
And your guard is up.
And your guard is constantly up, all the time. If you walk out of a door, look both ways. If you walk into a shower, you better look around. If you go sit on the stool and try to use the bathroom, be careful because it could be somebody standing up over you with a weapon. So you have to be careful. Prison is like that. Prison is not a place where you would want to anybody in your family to experience.
And are you you've been out now since?
I've been out since December the 14th.
And are you feeling less on guard? Is it happening for you?
Well, I'm getting help. You know, I think that anybody that has been locked up for as long as I have would have some type of trauma. And so what I've done this for myself. Nobody has said that I had to do this, but I've sought therapy. I've sought psychological counseling. And these things and these conversations that I have with my therapist that I have every week, I go every Thursday for therapy, helps me to adjust back to society, to get used to living again. The conversations that we have, we spend an hour, and she tries to give me guidance on the things that I should do, the things that I shouldn't do. I knew pretty much the things that I shouldn't do, but I need to know the things that I should do in order to get past the position that I am in now, which is like a stalemate. But I want to get to the point where as though I can, you know, be happy, just mm-hmm. like anybody else, find a home, get a home, maybe find me a girlfriend, you know, and just
live your life.
Live my life.
And to think that after 47 years, you get to choose what you will do, when you will do it, what you will eat. How does that feel to have the power of your life back in your hands?
That is an extraordinary feeling. Just to be able to turn the lights on, just to be able to take a shower. Do you know, I hadn't, up until that time that I got out, I hadn't taken a bath. Mm. There are no baths in prison. I hadn't taken a bath in 47 years. So that was a comforting experience. I set me some candles out there, cut the lights on, put some bubble bath in there, and went for it. Turned it hot and just sit back and tried to let all the 47 years of pressure, tension, and everything else just melt away into the water.
Did it work?
It worked.
It worked.
I felt good.
When I look at you and I think that 47 years that you did, you're the nation's longest serving exonerated prisoner, and you've said you don't harbor bitterness or resentment or anger about what has happened to you so long wrongfully imprisoned, and that is remarkable, and it's hard to get my head around that when I thought about this. How have you gotten, Richard, to this place of forgiveness and working at letting go of the injustice that was done to you?
Well, I look at it this way. If you have animosity, if you're the type of person that carries animosity, then quite naturally, when something traumatic happens to you, you'll feel hurt and you dislike the process. You'll dislike a lot of the people involved in the process. You'll dislike the people that put you through what you had to go through. But I realized at some point, and I guess it had a lot to do with my spiritual acceptance, because I had to just say, well, look, this is a little bit too rough for me. I had to put it in God's hands. And so having gone through all that, I said to myself, then if I ever want anybody to forgive me for the things that I've done in the past, then I also have to do the same thing. And so I just decided that I would forgive everybody that has done everything wrong to me, including Fred Mitchell, because I kind of halfway understood where he was coming from when he did what he did, because you're not going to find very few people. You're not going to find very many people that's going to just say, I did something, send me away for life, as opposed to saying, he did it, send him away for life. Not too many people are just going to raise their hand and go away for the rest of their lives.
But you were the unlucky guy that he pointed to.
That's right. And self-preservation is the first law of nature. So that's what Fred Mitchell resorted to.
And that
I don't like what he did.
Right.
But I understand it.
That is something. If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Richard Phillips, who, after 47 years in jails and prison, has been released. He was exonerated. In fact, he is the nation's longest-serving exonerated prisoner. Over the years, did you try to get your story out there? You knew you didn't commit this murder.
I have tried numerous times, numerous appeals, you name it. Never gave up. As soon as one appeal would get turned down, I'd start constructing another one. Sometimes they would say, well, you've already filed this or you've already covered this issue. It didn't matter. I was going to keep putting paperwork into the courts and flood the court system for the rest of my life if I had to. But, hey, to no avail. It had to come from some other source in order for me to get my freedom. None of my appeals worked. Now I look back and I say to those people that were denying my appeals, the prosecutors that were fighting the case, I hope they can look back and also see that you're not always right. You can make mistakes too. And I understand that. And this is the reason why I'm not so bitter, because I know that everybody makes mistakes.
When the Michigan Innocence Clinic came to you and said, here's what we've learned, what did you feel?
I felt a sense of exhilaration, because there also was the sense that maybe there's a light. In other words, the door didn't open all the way, but there was a crack. I seen a little bit of light, and it made me feel, I don't know, like I had a chance. And as we went along, and the more and more that they investigated the case and brought me the information that they did, because there was a lot of information that I didn't have. I didn't know that Richard Palumbo was sitting in the back seat when Fred Mitchell shot that guy in the head. I didn't know that until they explained to me that he admitted it. Never once in all that time that I knew him.
You thought he was also framed.
I thought he was framed too. So I accepted it.
And then pieces come together. But it still takes a while for the system. How did you keep together day in, day out, thinking there is a light down there, but it's not? I'm not there yet.
Well, actually, my motivation really come from the fact that I believed in God, and I believe that at no time would God actually abandon me and just allow me to spend the rest of my life in prison for something that I didn't do. This was just my belief. This is the way I tried to accept it and embrace it. I put the spiritual aspect up to it, and I said that God is not going to let me stay here for the rest of my life for something that I didn't do. And he didn't. I mean, it took him a while to get it done, but I'm happy that he did.
And here you are. Was there a chaplain? Was there someone inside that was helpful to you that you could turn to? Or were you kind of going it alone all those years?
Well, I was pretty much going it alone. You know, I was trying to deal with what had happened to me. And then after so many years days go by, somebody counted the days one time, and I think they said it was like 16 or 17,000 days and nights, miserable, lonely, stressful nights that I had to spend thinking about the fact that my life had been taken away from me for no just reason at all. And the system at that point just seemed like a failure to me. And then, like when the light started and the door started opening up, I said, well, maybe the system does work. The checks and balances does work, but it needs to be refined to the point where everybody gets their due justice in court and they get to be, I don't know how you would say, exposed to the rights and wrongs of the justice system and allowed to get back into society, especially if you haven't done anything. In my case, I hadn't done anything. And the thing that is really interesting, as far as I'm concerned, which a lot of people don't know, is the fact that I not only got convicted of a murder that I didn't do. I got convicted of an armed robbery that I didn't do. Fred Mitchell also committed an armed robbery about, I guess, probably the same year, 71. And the people that were robbed picked me out of the lineup and said that I was the one that was involved, when it was actually Fred Mitchell the one that was involved. And so I ended up getting 7 to 22 for an armed robbery out of Oakland County that I didn't do. Most people don't even know that. I was in prison when they came with the charge of murder. They didn't come to me. They went to Richard Palumbo and interviewed him. Mm-hmm. They didn't even interview me.
You didn't
even it was almost him. Like if I was a consolation prize. They was just taking me along for the ride. And so I ended up having, when they interviewed Mr. Palumbo in prison, because he took a cop to the armed robbery. He was involved in the armed robbery. Him and Fred Mitchell actually was the one that robbed the store. But I got picked out for it. Fred Mitchell got away scot-free. Both cases, the armed robbery and the murder. The armed robbery is still on my file in Oakland County right now. They're trying to
examine. Working on that.
They're trying to work on that, too. But I was just so, I don't know, just so caught up in the fact of the murder case that I wanted to get that off me that I really wasn't concerned about the armed robbery.
And as that was kind of building steam, I understand you were offered a deal at one point by prosecutors that would have gotten you out sooner. And why didn't you take it?
Well, when Dave Moran came to me and spoke to me, he said, well, look, I might be able to get you a deal here because that way we won't have to go to court. And, you know, the prosecutors seem as though they're acceptable in accepting a plea bargain just to get it off the court. They just don't want to make it appear as though they were the ones at fault. And at that time, I told him, and I still say today, that I would rather die in prison than to admit to a murder that I did not commit. And that still stands today.
I understand you are quite the gifted artist.
I don't know about all that. Well, I have some talent.
Tell me about making art. Why do you do it? What kind of art do you make?
I do all kind of art. My specialty or my main love is watercolor. I do them all, but watercolor is the one medium that I work in the most because actually it's coincidental that I work with watercolor. I ordered an acrylic set years ago. And they sent me the wrong set, so I said, well, I got it. I might as well use it. And from there, I actually taught myself how to use watercolor. It's the most difficult medium there is.
And had you ever done anything like this before you went away?
No.
So this is something
I
you
had
just
the got? Artistic talent.
Okay.
In school, as a youngster, the only class that I ever got all A's in was art and gym. Art and gym. Everything else was I don't even want to talk about. I don't even talk about the other subject. But art and gym, I got straight A's.
So you're making art now, and I bet that has to be part of just getting settled and healed.
That's where I get my comfort at. I can escape the world when I can get into one of my paintings and start applying colors and get actually off into some of the scenes, especially the landscaping scenes. I can once I get caught up in it and have music transferring in my ears all at the same time, I'll actually be right into the painting. My mind is focused inside that. And so this is one of the reasons why when I was in prison, it would give me an opportunity to escape because my mind was somewhere else inside this art, creating the art, the colors, applying them on the paper or whatever, instead of being outside where they're fighting, stabbing, acting crazy, doing whatever. Prison life is like that. Something is going on all the time, every day. And so one of the best ways to stay out of that is to actually apply yourself to some other medium or some other interest. And that way you can stay away from a lot of the nonsense that goes on in prison. Because out of all the years, which is remarkable, I had one of the guards to tell me at a commutation hearing that I had back in 2009. Mm-hmm. He said, if your prison record was enough to let you go on alone, I only had, say, like 4 misconduct reports out of 47 years. whereas some people get 4 misconduct reports in 1 week. You get these kids that come through there nowadays, they don't care about nothing. They don't care about nobody. They don't have anything on the street. They don't have no life on the street. See, prison now is like a badge of honor. Oh, I've been to the joint. That's the first thing you hear somebody say. But that prison is no place to be somebody. Believe me. You're going to be abused, used, taken advantage of. You'll get accused of things you don't do. And I've been there, so I've experienced it all.
You have said in interviews when you were exonerated, Richard Phillips, that you really, really hope to reconnect with your own 2 children who were, what, 2 and 4 when all of this began for you way back in 1972. How has that gone for you?
Well, I've managed to contact my ex-wife. We've talked, and my son is staying with her, and we're in the process of mending all our relationships right now. My daughter, she stays in France, so I haven't had a chance to really contact or speak to her yet, but she comes over here to the United States 2 or 3 times a year, so eventually we're going to all get together and meet up and try to get back together. And my wife and I are now just mutually friends, which is good. You know, I was hoping that it would turn out that way. Sometimes, you know, you get a divorce and people begin to hate one another and they don't want you to be around or talk to you, but that's not the case with us. At least we're adult enough to realize that, you know, when you're young, mistakes are made, you go through processes that don't last forever. So, you know, it was an experience.
I think I'm sensing some hope that you're carrying, that this will kind of come together and this family connection will get stronger.
It'll get strong. It'll definitely get stronger. If it's on me, it'll get stronger. I know that.
What are some of your other goals now?
My next goal is to get an automobile so that I'll have transportation. Right now, I don't have transportation. And so I have to try to somehow manage to either save enough money, acquire enough money to be able to purchase an automobile because I need my transportation. I couldn't have got here today if Dave Moran hadn't made it available for someone to come and pick me up. And so I need my transportation to be able to go to doctor's office, whatever, you know, and come here for this interview today. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have been able to make it if I'd had to go depend on myself. They don't have a bus line running from one city to Ann Arbor, so I wouldn't have made it. So that's my next goal. And then a home, I'm looking to get me a pet. I've always said that I wanted a dog, so I'll probably end up getting me a German Shepherd puppy or something to grow up with. And after that, just live life, maybe travel, see how things go.
Because you're a young guy. You've got a lot of time left on this earth.
I don't know about me. I don't know about young, but I feel young.
How do you think your story could show our criminal justice system how to do better?
Well, for one thing, it would show them that all the convictions that they acquired over the years are not necessarily rightful convictions. It shows that mistakes are made, and that there should be some type of safeguards put in place to protect people, especially like me, where you'll have someone just come into court and just saying, oh, he told me he killed somebody. They never, in my particular case, no one ever said they saw me do anything. No one ever said that they saw me even in the same vicinity as the crime scene. No one said that they had fingerprints or anything dealing with that particular case associated with me. Fred Mitchell just said that I told him, and that could happen to anyone. That could happen to you. Mm-hmm. I could go to police right now and say, you told me something. And that doesn't mean that it's right for them to send you away for the rest of your life based upon just what I just said. Who said that you told me anything? There's no witness for that. But yet and still, you have to go spend the next 50 years in life based upon what somebody said that you said. Not that they seen anything, not that they have any evidence or any guns or bullets, fingerprints, just someone saying that you told me this, and the jury believes it. You gone. for 50 years. That could happen to you, your mother, your brother, your father, your sister, someone in your family. Think about that. Just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, you could end up gone.
Richard Phillips, who spent 47 years behind bars for a crime he did not commit, the longest-serving exoneree in U.S. history. Richard, thank you so much for being with us, for sharing your story, and we are all wishing you the best as you build your new life.
Thank you for having me.